Well, welcome back to another in our series of studies on Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. We've just finished the account of the pilgrim's journey through the world, through Vanity Fair, where we've witnessed the death of faithful and Christians escape through the providence of God. As Bunyan turns the scene from there, he says, "Now I saw in my dream that Christian went not forth alone." The faithful dies, Christian escapes the prison, but Christian doesn't leave alone, for there was one whose name was Hopeful, being made hopeful by the beholding of Christian and Faithful in their words and behavior in their sufferings at the fair, who joined himself unto him, and entering into a brotherly covenant, told him that he would be his companion. Thus, says Bunyan, one died to make testimony to the truth, and another rises out of his ashes to be a companion with Christian in his pilgrimage. See, suffering well magnifies the glory and the worthiness of Christ and the Christian life. And what you see is that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And when Hopeful, who was obviously not hopeful when he was in Vanity Fair, saw Christian and Faithful, and especially Faithful, suffer unto death, he became hopeful and recalled the words that the men spoke and believed in the gospel. And so, Christian, being bereft of one companion, receives another. This is the Christian life. We exist to replicate ourselves, to make converts, to ensure that there are others who come up after us, entrusting things to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. And so Christian and Hopeful now continue on the journey. And they meet a man named Byends, and a byend is a secret purpose. It's a hidden agenda. So here's a man who might be called, you know, secret agenda, hidden agenda. And they begin their talk, and they have a little introduction, and Byends himself later on gives a really good summary of the interaction between him and Faithful and Christian. He says he's talking to his friends who catch up with him a little bit later. And they say, "Who were those two that you were talking to?" And he says, "Why, they, after their headstrong manner, conclude that it is their duty to rush on their journey all weathers. And I am for waiting for wind and tide. They are for hazarding all for God at a clap. And I am for taking all advantages to secure my life and estate. They are for holding their notions, though all other men be against them. But I am for religion in what and so far as the times and my safety will bear it. They are for religion when in rags and contempt. But I am for him when he walks in his golden slippers in the sunshine and with applause." So Byends is someone who he's basically a prosperity preacher. He's basically a pragmatist, someone who is happy to go along with Christianity when the wind is blowing in Christianity's direction, when things aren't too difficult. He's a culturally approved Christian. He's Christian when the culture approves of it, and not Christian when the culture doesn't. When things get difficult, he's not interested in following after Christ. He says he doesn't want to go against wind and tide. He doesn't want religion in rags as well as in silver slippers, but only when there's sunshine. And Faithful tells him, "You know what? You and I aren't walking together." Sorry, not Faithful. Christian tells him, "You and I aren't walking together, not a step further, because there is no fellowship that light has with darkness, and you, sir, are in darkness," which is a bold way to speak to someone whom you've just met, but it shows you the faithful testimony of the Christian against those who are false professors. And so anyway, Byends' friends catch up to him. And there are a number of them. There are Mr. Money Love and Mr. Save All and Mr. Hold the World and Mr. Love Gain and Mr. Gripe Man, all from the town of Coveting. These are the prosperity preachers. These are the health, wealth, and prosperity types who believe that it's okay to basically pretend to be a Christian, even a minister, a pastor, so long as you can improve your estate. And the funny thing is that these guys are serious about marrying personal prosperity with Christian truth. And you know, you'd think that some of them would just be out and out hucksters. Like, how can we deceive people? These people seem to think that what they're doing is virtuous. And the way that Bunyan shows us that is to have Baez propound to his friends a riddle where he says, suppose a man, a minister or a tradesman, etc., should have an advantage lie before him to get the good blessings of this life, yet so as that he can by no means come by them, except in appearance at least, he becomes extraordinarily zealous in some points of religion that he meddled not with before. May he not use this means to attain his end and yet be a right and honest man? In other words, let's say someone sees the opportunity to gain worldly blessings, but the only way he can get those blessings is to appear as very, very zealous for the things of religion. Let's say he goes ahead and appears very zealous for the things of religion, and he gets those good things in the earth. Why is that dishonest? And the four friends wax eloquent and poetic about how, by becoming religious, he may mend his market. Maybe he'll get a rich wife, more or far and better customers to his shop. You know, if he alters some of his principles but ends up in a better state, well, who cares? If he has to pretend to be more exact in his religion, that'll only tend to his good. No, it's wise and prudent and shrewd for such a man to act this way. And they all sort of pat themselves on the back and assure them of their genuineness, and they continue in their greed and their love of money. Well, eventually, they're so confident and proud in their sophistry that they come back up to Christian and Hopeful, and they say, hey, let's try that answer on them, because surely they'll agree that our principles are right, and they'll see that they were wrong to account us so lightly earlier on as phony Christians. Well, and they propound the riddle to Christian. Actually, Mr. Hold the World does, because they figure, well, Bayan, they don't like you anymore, so here, I'll do it. And so Christian responds, even a babe in religion may answer 10,000 such questions. For if it be unlawful to follow Christ for loaves, as in John 6, how much more abominable is it to make of him and religion a stalking horse to get and enjoy the world? A stalking horse is a false pretense. And so Christian says, look, the crowds in John 6, when Jesus, you know, fed 5,000 by multiplying the loaves and the fish, they came back and they said, hey, you know, let's do this again. And then Jesus sends them all away by speaking of eating his flesh and drinking his blood. And he says, look, if that shows that it's wrong to follow Christ for breakfast, it's wrong to follow Christ for having a full belly. Well, if that's plain in John 6, surely it's wrong to follow Christ to get more of and enjoy the world that that God himself has set himself, you know, viciously against. Again, do not love the world, because all that is in the world is not of the Father. If you're a friend of the world, you're at enmity with God, James 4:4 says. And of course, fresh in Christian's mind is the worldliness that he just left at Vanity Fair that claimed the life of his dear friend. And so he's saying worldliness is just as disgusting as a mercenary spirit of following Christ for what he can give you. And then he explains, well, think of when Hamor and Shechem had a mind to the daughters and cattle of Jacob in Genesis 34. They were acting mercenarily, and God condemned them. The hypocritical Pharisees were also of this religion. Their prayers were long because of pretense, but they did it to get widows' houses, to devour widows' houses. Judas, the devil, was also of this religion. He was religious for the bag. Remember, Judas was the treasurer. He kept the bag, and when he was indignant that perfume not be sold to give money to the poor, he was really only saying, I want the money in this bag that I can skim off of for my own greediness. And he talks about Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8, that he says that was his religion too, for he would have had the Holy Ghost that he might have got money therewith, and that his sentence from Peter's mouth was according, your money perish with you, you phony. You thought you could buy the Spirit of God with money. That's where we get the term simony from, those who make a pretense of religion in order to extort money from people. And so, I mean, he's just one, two, three after another. He's given all examples of why prosperity doctrine is just hellish. And then he says this wonderful line. He says, neither will it out of my mind, but that that man that takes up religion for the world will throw away religion for the world. The one who makes a pretense of following after Christ because of what advantages he thinks it will gain him in society, whether those be monetary, whether they be, you know, societal, like I'll have this friend and that connection, this job that I can get, whatever it may be. If the tides turn and the fair weather turns to storms and the silver slippers turn to rags, then that same man is going to throw religion away because he wants to gain the world. See, his God hasn't changed. It's his mode of worship of his God has changed. He still worships greed. He still worships lucre. He still worships the world. He still worships approval. He still worships ease. In one season, he could worship those gods by a pretense of Christianity. In another season, he'll worship them when he has to leave off Christianity to do so. The man that takes up religion for the world will throw away religion for the world. The man who follows Christ, quote unquote, for the world will desert Christ for the world. One who takes up Christianity and spirituality for the world will throw away Christianity and spirituality for the world. And so to accept the religion that you guys propound, Christian says, is heathenish, hypocritical, and devilish, and your reward will be according to your works. And it says, and they stood staring upon one another. They just, I don't know what to say. You know, okay, I guess that's the answer. And it says, there was a great silence among them. And then said Christian to Hopeful, if these men cannot stand before the sentence of men, what will they do with the sentence of God? And if they are mute when dealt with by vessels of clay, what will they do when they shall be rebuked by the flames of a devouring fire? So you don't have to worry about passing my judgment or making a display of my failure to reason. You have to worry about convincing God at the bar of his judgment, which you will stand before at the end of your days. Will your practice make stand a trial at law? Christian asked way back earlier in the narrative when he was speaking with formalist and hypocrisy. But will your practice stand a trial at law? And here Bunyan makes the same point. You don't have to satisfy Christians. You have to satisfy Christ. And Christians, insofar as they are faithful to represent that same standard to people, are your friends, not your judges. Well, then they move on to a delicate plain called Ease, where they went with much content. But that plain was both narrow, so they were quickly got over it. So there's a little bit of rest, but it doesn't last long. They on the further side of that plain was a little hill called Lucre, and in that hill was silver mine, filthy lucre, sordid gain. The idea that we speak of the word lucrative as something that generates a lot of money. So lucre is the love of money. And then they find a man in a silver mine named Demas, which, you know, is not subtle. Yeah, Bunyan is speaking of the man of Scripture named Demas who loved the present world and became apostate. And Demas says, hey, come here, turn out of your way and come stay by me. And I love this response from Christian. What thing so deserving? Well, Demas says, turn aside hither and I will show you a thing. Hey, I got something to show you. And Christian says, what thing so deserving as to turn us out of the way? What could you possibly have to show me that is more desirable and rewarding than the way of following Christ? Boy, I love that response. Well, Demas says, here's a silver mine and some digging in it for treasure. And Hopeful says, oh, hey, treasure, let's go see. And Christian says, nope, not me. I've heard of this place before now and how many have there been slain. And besides, that treasure is a snare to those that seek it, for it hinders them in their pilgrimage. And that's an illustration of the blessings of fellowship. Here's Hopeful, a young believer who's tempted to go out of the way for the sake of worldly treasure. And he has an experienced elder brother who's alongside him saying, nope, that's no treasure at all, brother. Come on, let's be on our way. And eventually Christian says to Demas, you are an enemy to the right ways of the Lord of this way. and you have already been condemned for your own turning aside. And Demas cries out. He says, I'm also one of your fraternity, and if you would tarry a little while, I would walk with you. He says, hey, take it easy, man. I'm on your side. I'm a Christian too, which is the way that a lot of false professors, false believers speak. Hey, we're Christians. We believe in Jesus. We just believe that you have to add works to your faith in order to be justified before him. Or we believe in Jesus. We just believe that he's the Son of God, but not God himself, not Almighty God. And we believe in Jesus, but we just believe that that he's a good teacher and a wise prophet, but not obviously God. God is one. There are a lot of people who claim to believe in Jesus who will persist that they're Christians as well, but are no true Christians at all. Well, they move past Demas. They see an old monument that looks like it was in the shape of a woman turned into a pillar. And, of course, this is a reference to Lot's wife, who was turned into a pillar of salt for loving the world. You remember the story out of Genesis 19, the angels coming to rain fire out of heaven, and they urge Lot and his wife to be up and get out of there. And Lot's wife turns back because of her love of her of the present world, of her present condition of worldliness. And she becomes a pillar of salt as a testimony to everybody who would not flee lust and flee worldliness and flee immorality, but would long after and pine after those things that they have been told to leave behind. Christian says, oh, this is a seasonable sight. Came right after Demas's invitation to view the hill Lucre. And had we gone over as he desired us, as you were inclined to do, my brother, we would, for all I know, have been made ourselves like this woman, a spectacle for those that shall come after to behold. Hopeful says, I'm sorry that I was so foolish, and I'm made to wonder that I'm not now as Lot's wife. For wherein was the difference between her and me? What was the difference between her sin and mine? She looked back, and I had a desire to go see. Let grace be adored, and let me be ashamed that ever such a thing should be in my heart. Note two things here. Hopeful says, what's the difference between me and Lot's wife? She just turned back. And me, I had a desire to go. He recognizes that the chief part of temptation is in the heart, in the desires. It doesn't matter merely that you didn't go, but it matters that you wanted to go. And there's sin to you in the desire for that which is sinful. And he recognizes that. I had a desire to go see. And then it says, let grace be adored and let me be ashamed. That could be the motto of the Christian. May grace be praised. Let's exalt the grace of God and let me be ashamed and bow to the dust. Because I've got nothing worthy in me to exalt, and I'm only what I am by the grace of God. He must increase, I must decrease. Christian says, let us take notice of what we see here for our help for the time to come. This woman escaped one judgment, for she fell not by the destruction of Sodom, yet she was destroyed by another. As we see, she is turned into a pillar of salt. Don't get out of one judgment just to be consumed by another. Don't fight against one sin only to fall into the trap of another. You have to press against all sin, press against all temptation, to avoid all judgment, because that is the path of blessing. And so then they go on and they start marveling at one another, asking, how is it that Demas could be so close to this pillar of salt, which obviously stands as a monument to not be embroiled by the sins of greediness and sordid gain? Here she is warning you not to go that direction, and here he is doing that very thing. And Christian says it's a thing to be wondered at, and it argues that their heart is grown desperate in the case. And I can't tell who to compare them to so fitly as to them that pick pockets in the presence of the judge, or him that will cut purses under the gallows. Here are people committing crimes right under the nose of the judge of all the earth. How can they expect to be free when they come to the bar of his judgment? They commit those crimes right in his sight. And given the omniscience of God, friends, We, when we sin, are those who are like pickpockets that do so, that pickpockets in the sight of the judge, that we're the ones who cut purses, steal people's purses right in front of the guillotine or in front of the gallows whereby we might be hanged. God sees all, and his omniscience should be a wonderful comfort to those of us that are in Christ, that no matter what he sees of us, his grace keeps us. But it also ought to be a warning that we not play as pickpockets in the midst of the judge, that we conduct ourselves as we would if we were always in the personal presence of God, in the personal presence of Christ, as if he was standing next to us, because he is indeed with us. And so Christian eventually says that even such as these are, that sin in the sight, yea, and that too in despite of such examples that are set continually before them to caution them to the contrary, must be partakers of the severest judgments. What a warning to us who stand in the way of such wonderful warnings out of the scriptures. Those of us who by grace are well taught, we need to guard that we don't sin in the sight of and in despite such great examples, and thus incur severe judgment. Well, he says, I saw then they went on their way to a pleasant river, which David the king called the river of God, but John the river of the water of life. And their way lay just upon the bank of the river, and so they walked with great delight. And I think this is a wonderful flourish from Bunyan's pen. So he's just gone through Vanity Fair, where they've had to despise all worldliness and even sacrifice a faithful brother unto death. Then he's come into this conflict with these worldly prosperity, health, wealth type preachers who love the world and who just want religion when it's easy and want all the satisfaction and the happiness they can suck out of the present world. And Christian, you know, is exhorting Hopeful not to go after the promise of that satisfaction. And then what does Bunyan do immediately after that? He gives them satisfaction. He gives them rest. He gives them ease. These other men, they've made ease their God. They've made pleasure their God, and their pleasure is in worldly pleasures, in fleshly pleasures. But what does Bunyan do? He says, when you resist those worldly pleasures, when you resist the fleshly pleasures, you enjoy the spiritual pleasures of refreshment like the water of life, the river of life. See, I've said it before and I'll say it again. And I'll say it again after this time too, but that we don't fight the temptation to sinful pleasures with the absence of pleasure, with trying to tell us that it's just selfish for us to want good things. No, we fight the temptation to sinful pleasures by the power of a superior pleasure, by the promise of our reward, by the glory of the crown we're seeking, by the fellowship of the King that satisfies us and quenches the thirst of our soul like the deer pants for the water brooks. Bunyan's trying to teach that whenever we despise the pleasures of the world, God is there to supply the pleasures of his grace, and that they are so much more enjoyable than anything the world could offer. And so they went in, they found themselves by a meadow after they were by this river. They went to lie down safely. And they awoke, and they gathered from the fruit of the trees and drank again from the water of the river and lay down asleep once more. And they did thus several days and nights. And then they sang, behold ye how these crystal streams do glide to comfort pilgrims by the highway side. The meadows green, besides their fragrant smell, yield dainties for them. And he that can tell what pleasant fruit, yea, leaves these trees do yield, will soon sell all that he may buy this field. Matthew 13:44, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field which a man found, and from joy over it he went and sold all he had that he might buy that field. And you see, if you despise the pleasures of the flesh and of the world, from joy over the treasures you shall find, you would gladly give everything you have to lay hold of them. The Christian life, the faithful life, the path of obedience and fellowship with Christ is so much more desirable and satisfying than the path of disobedience in the world. Fight the power of a temptation to sinful pleasure with the power of a superior pleasure.